You can find more information, photos, and advice sheets on all the plants and recipes that we talk about in this podcast by heading to the links in the show notes or on our website at sarahoven.com. Welcome to Grow, Cook, Eat, Arrange, the podcast between myself, Arthur Parkinson, and my good friend Sarah Raven. On this episode, Sarah's taking a break and I'm interviewing my dear Instagram friend, Anne-Marie Powell. Anne-Marie is a garden designer, she's a writer, she's also a presenter, but some of you will know her due to her amazing Instagram account. And Anne-Marie kept a lot of us going all the way through lockdown by creating this incredible Instagram account called My Real Garden. And the energy she's got at being a public face on Instagram is incredible. Every day during lockdown, almost without fail, I remember going on Instagram and there would be Anne's circle saying live, and she'd be there smiling for us all, gardening, basically giving us tours of her garden, taking you through scratch, holding your hand if you'd never pricked out a seedling before or sowing a seed tray. And it was remarkable, her energy. And I'm really looking forward to this September because I've got the honour of taking armfuls and bucketfuls of dahlias and beautiful annuals from the garden here at Perchill, Sarah's garden, to Chelsea, where I'm going to arrange these flowers on Anne-Marie's stand, which is a furniture stand, which she's going to do a garden around. And we'll start off by talking about that, I think, Anne-Marie.
I'm so excited to get you on Main Avenue.
Maybe when you see the suit I've got.
Oh, wait until you see what I'm going to wear. We'll stand out, I'm sure.
God. We should say, shouldn't we? So Chelsea is, you're kind of a pro at Chelsea, aren't you? It is your territory, this whole show gardening business. Let's not pretend.
I do enjoy it. So it's what really kind of hooked me into garden design properly back in 1997 when I did my first, I went as a student to help Zara Tolomash on her garden for the Evening Standard, and she just couldn't shake me off, I don't think.
So you've really got the bug.
It is absolutely the most wonderful thing, and it's addictive. So I have not missed a show apart from when my now 12-year-old was born back in 2009, since 1997. So I adore it. I absolutely adore it. So I'm really pleased to be there for Gaze Burville. So their furniture, they're very local to me here, about 15 minutes drive away in Hampshire. And they make the most exquisite furniture, and it kind of has a traditional bent, but the work that they do is super, super contemporary. What they can do with oak, with steam bending and washing and this, that and the other, it makes these most exquisite kind of timeless pieces of furniture. So to arrange a garden around their pieces is actually a real honour, and it's wonderful that you can share that with me, with your gorgeous, gorgeous displays and your joyful colour, which we hope to echo in all the planting. And the stand keeps on getting bigger and bigger, gets more and more gardeny. I'm just going, let's just stretch it more so we've got even more plants.
onto next door. Push, keep pushing.
Yeah, land grabbing at Chelsea. Let's do the whole of Main Avenue, Arthur.
Yeah. So let's take our listeners back to you before you were at Chelsea. What was it that got you interested in gardening? Was it a childhood thing? When did it come about?
I think it was actually the lack of having a garden, to be honest.
Really?
So, yeah, my dad was in the army. They were super young when they had me. They were 17 when my mum got pregnant. And yeah, we moved every 2 years to a different house, so you never ever had a chance to put down any roots. And my granddad up in Leeds, he had lived in a tiny back-to-back terrace, and he had an allotment, and he was a miner, so he spent his days in the dark, and then in the evening and in the spare days that he had off, he'd be down his allotment, and on the odd weekend that we could get there, I just saw that magic and what joy it brought for him. So, and as an army squaddy kid, my parents managed to send me to boarding school because it's completely kind of backed up by army funding. So, and they were determined to kind of educate me and my sister up into a different way of living. Their lives had always been really tough and money was super tight always. And that was up in Derbyshire. So beautiful.
Yeah,
so,
my neck of the woods almost.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I know you are mad, fond memories of Chatsworth. And I remember going there as, on school trips and also being completely overwhelmed. And I have to admit, Arthur, I took every opportunity by the horns. So, you know, from coming from a really working class background, I was off to the ballet, to the opera, D&B, in all the sports squads, the choral society. I did everything. I learned to forge my mum's signature. So, and whenever any opportunities came up, I was there doing it. But one of the things about my school was that it had its grounds and they grew an awful lot of food for the table actually on site. So from going there to be from being 11, coming from really small, basically squaddies quarters of squares of grass to seeing, you know, gardeners and people growing food again and making them happy and that we could eat it and play in it and drink cider in the rhododendron bushes and the like, it was like a whole new world had opened up. So when I first moved to a house with my boyfriend, perhaps overly young, and he had a garden, well, I was off. I was just, that was it.
That was it. And you knew that was your calling in life. So when did the idea that you could be a standalone garden designer come about? Because I personally find that world quite intimidating.
I think it can be quite intimidating, really. And sometimes you've just got to have a bit of metal to kind of just be yourself. So, you know, I am really interested in what I'm doing, which sounds a bit navel-gazing, but that's a sort of safety net.
Yeah,
it's a safety net. So don't look over the garden fence at what other garden designers are doing.
Yes.
If you're true to yourself and kind of your vocation and what you want to do, then, you know, you're not competing with anybody. You're just creating beautiful spaces for people that want them. But for me, I went traveling. I was traveling for about 2 years in my early 20s, India, Nepal, Singapore, Thailand, and just seeing Mother Nature swirl her skirts across landscapes and colour and beauty and wonderfulness, and New Zealand covered with lupins, which they shouldn't be, but they are. I just, when I came back, I just thought, no, I've got to make a career in this. And I took loads of career advice and I wanted to be a gardener. But it became apparent then, back in the mid-90s, that I wouldn't earn the money that I wanted to do. And I had a background in art and I did English literature A-level and things like that. So, and I were dropped out of textile college. So everybody kept on saying, you know, do design. So I did. That's what I went and trained at Capel Manor.
So art was a big thing.
Yeah, art and textiles. And I was pushed. I was quite bright at school. And I was pushed into A-levels that I didn't want to do. And I ended up doing geography, history and English lit and general studies that I failed. I think I must be the only person in the world that failed general studies.
What's general studies?
I don't know if they still do it, but it's basically whether you read the paper.
Right.
Keep up with current affairs, okay. I think, really. Just general life studies and I'm afraid I never did.
Right.
So at those days, I was much more interested in the bar and parties than reading the newspaper. But and I really wanted to do art, music and English lit. So when I dropped out of college and decided doing textiles course that was much more science-based than I ever cared for it to be, I was determined that I did something that I loved. My granddad had told me that. Just, you know, they call me Ree. Do what you love and you'll never work in your life, which is a bit of a cheesy phrase, but it's so true. And although my working life is intense and it's hard, don't get me wrong, it's, you know, it is hard. You have to strive to run a business every single day of your life. And I work ridiculously long hours. It is my life, you know, everything that I do, the people that I hang out with, what I do in my spare time, and my daily work life, what I do first thing in the morning, it's all plants, horticultural garden design. I love it.
Yeah. So, and you can sense that from you. You can sense that you're happy. And I think that's why so many people have latched onto you on Instagram because you're just genuinely happy. And there's the energy that you get from you when you watch these lives that you do. So the garden design started. Did you start working for someone first? When did you become your brand? When did you think, actually, I've got enough behind me to stand up on my own two feet and say, yes, I'm a garden designer. I can do a garden for you.
Well, what happened was I went and I did garden design and hard landscaping at Capel Manor College up in Enfield. And I did an intensive year course. And when I came out, I thought my plant knowledge just isn't up to scratch. So I went to work at tender care nurseries, and I can still walk up and down the aisles. And that's how I know, you know, the herbaceous and the trees and shrubs. So I'm still selecting from those aisles 25 years on. And essentially what happened then was my boss, Angela Hawksworth, a fax came around for a TV program. And she applied for me without me knowing about it.
Wow.
So I suddenly got a call from a television production company to do a series called Garden Doctors, which was presented by Dan Pearson at the time. And he was kind of my idol. I just thought, my goodness me, there's someone doing exactly what I want to do. When actually in the mid 90s, people in their 20s and early 30s like me, who were interested in horticulture and garden design and landscape, were very few and far between. So I would watch him and just be completely inspired. So when I was suddenly about to do a tele program with him, I went up to meet the production company and yes, I got the job. And suddenly I was in a world without Dan Pearson because he decided that it was time for him to stand by when I got a job as this.
Really?
No, it wasn't me. He'd done it for 3 years. I do know Dan quite well now. So I know it wasn't me. So I was suddenly thrown into TV and I did it for about 4 or 5 years, pretty much full time.
I think you can YouTube these for anyone listening who's wanting to see Anne-Marie in action. I might do that after this podcast, actually.
There are still some on Real Gardens on Channel 4, I have to say, with Monty and Carol. But it was really good fun. It was really hard work. And I was doing all manner of things, helping people with their own gardens, designing gardens. And it's really where I cut my teeth. So on television, some of it live with designing gardens. But I was suddenly thrown into a world where I didn't really have any control of how I was kind of perceived to be. And also I didn't have any control of my time. And I was suddenly sort of working relentlessly hard, existing on 2 and 3 hours sleep.
Yeah.
And then I met Jules, who's now my husband. And he, when I met him, I was in the middle of a 56-day long shoot back to back. And I met him at a party, sort of. I shouldn't have been there, but I was. And he waited until I came back. And then we had a month of revelry and wonder we survived. And after a while, he just said, he could see that I wasn't happy. So he just said, why don't you give it up? Yeah. And nobody had ever told me that I could get off the bike.
Because you'd done well enough to get on.
Yeah, exactly.
To have permission to get off and actually put yourself first and... Yeah, good advice.
Yeah, it was really having, you know, a huge impact on my mental health, I think. I was exhausted. I was kind of spread all over the place. I kind of was not really liking what I was doing on television or how I was perceived to be. And I just thought, this is just not what I kind of signed up for, really. So I got off the bike, stood it in the corner, still there if something comes along that I fancy doing every now and again. But and I set up in practice properly after trying to run it alongside very badly a lot of TV and media stuff. So, and that was hard, Arthur, because your clients, they don't watch television.
No.
So it was really like starting from a standstill. And then Archie came along, our eldest, 2004. So, and I was determined to keep on going. And then the recession hit in 2008 and then Gilbert arrived in 2009. Mm. So that period of 5 years was really backbreaking. But I felt like me again, Arthur. Yeah. And, you know, my clients, they sort of started to come and then I get recommended because I put my heart and soul into everything that I do. I wear a big, a big badge on my sleeve. So, and I just like to do, for jobs worth doing, do it well.
Because this all was before the advertising power of Instagram. So as a garden designer, were you like banking on a Gardens Illustrated mention? How as a garden illustrator back then or now, do you get your name out there in, you know, golden light territory?
It's recommendation. Every single time, word of mouth. Because if you do a good job for somebody and they like you, then they'll tell their friend.
Yeah.
And it's about that. And also getting into the right income bracket where people can afford. It's not really our services.
No.
It's the garden.
Yes.
If somebody can afford the garden that they want in their mind's eye, then they can certainly afford us, you know?
Yeah.
So, and what's happened over time is the size of garden has gone up and up and up and up. So, and the value of the garden has gone up and up and up. And the most important thing with garden design is that you have the correct meterage rate for that garden size. So, you know, if someone might say, you know, I've got want to spend $500,000 on a garden and it sounds like a lot of money, but if it's 10 acres, it's nothing. So we're always watching the meterage rate.
You've got your tape measures out.
We've got our tape measures out from the off,
visits.
I tell you.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, you just don't think about it.
But it's changed that landscape. That landscape has changed. And now there are so many garden designers. Then the social media profile and making sure you're on top of your marketing is super important. And the tech has changed. I mean, I used to be on my lovely drawing board with my rotary pens, and I've had to learn so much tech.
That CAD thing, is it?
That CAD thing.
Yeah. Well, I say that because I remember when I was at Kew, the people doing the 3-year diploma, they were spending hours after hours learning how to draw these circles. And I had a friend, Aaron, who has gone on to be a garden designer, and he was drawing these blobs, and then you can make them look like you've watercolored them in. And but it's all done on like a thing, isn't it? So you've measured out your garden on that screen, and it's just another world to me. You know, I'm still doing a decoupage is like the nitty gritty of design for me at home. So it must be, yeah, what a skill to have. I really do take my hat off to good designers such as yourself.
Oh, thanks, Arthur. I miss all of that, though, the cutting out and doing mood boards and things. It's. I used to love having my office at Kew, so just outside Kew and Kew Parade, and piles of magazines and cutting things out and drawing circles and being creative like that. And I do still do a bit of hand draw at the beginning, but the technology now
is important.
It's essential because of the kind of the scale of work that we're doing. We work with a lot of architects. Things have to go through planning. You can't revise things quickly if you hand draw, and you can't communicate paper as well as you can quickly do it on an email. So I honestly, when I started on Vectorworks, I wanted to throw my computer out the window. I wanted to smash it up with my trowel, my computer.
One thing I must ask, and then we're going to have to move on to Chelsea, but how do you manage somebody who say has, I don't know, been to Chelsea Flower Show, they've got, you know, 5 billion in the bank. Let's say it's a relative of whoever owns the Daily Mail now. And they come to you and they say, I want my garden to look like the Grand Pavilion. And you're thinking, okay, I need this client. It's going to be good word of mouth and a good thing for my portfolio, but this is going to be really hard to manage because they're going to be expecting a delphinium in December. How do you sort of groom that client to not rip your head off in 5 minutes of starting the job? Because people who don't garden, who've got money, they really do expect a lot, don't they, in a short space of time?
They really do. And it's all about communication and educating the client right from the off, and actually being quite firm.
Right.
So, and also, you know, if you can communicate what you're wanting to do and the client kind of buys in to your work, so because they've got, that's why they call you, because they like your work.
Yes.
So that's why they call you in the first instance, and they like you. And then it's really a dialogue at the beginning, and we spend a lot of time just talking to the client and making, I spend hours on a brief. Our briefs are, you know, this is before we've even got the job, are about 20 pages long.
Wow.
So I demonstrate what I want to do for that particular individual or family or company or charity, whatever. And I just want them to be invested. And then we are honest and open all the way through the whole process. So if there's a problem, phone us. Don't stew over it. Just let us know immediately and we will explain why we've done something, you know, or we will make that change if we think the client has got a really good point. But it's all about communication, because on large jobs, you know, with Wisley, for example, that went on for 5 years.
That's the wildlife garden you've just done. You should all look that up on Instagram. Yeah.
Yeah. So that dialogue, you've got to be able to communicate, because, you know, the gardens, if you are spending a lot of money, it's not going to be turned around in 6 months. That could be 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years. So it's a long process. Mm. So, and it was just talk, conversation, and hopefully mutual understanding.
Yeah. But of course, the Chelsea gardens are done within, well, some of them are done within, what's the shortest timeline you get to do a Chelsea garden? Is it 2 weeks or do you get a bit longer?
Yeah, we're just over 2 weeks for this one. So yeah, exactly. Mm. So, and it's quite a big space, you know, we've got about 150 square meters. So, you know, and there's 45 square meters of planting in that. So it's experience that enables you to do it that fast, to be honest.
Yeah.
And also communication again. So making sure the client's on board, that you've got a good contractor who understands how you work, and we're using Landform, who I've worked with many, many times. And we've been prepping it now, well, for 2 and a bit years, maybe 3 years actually. So it's kept on being delayed for good reason, obviously.
Yeah. And the outcome of having an autumnal Chelsea, I think, is I'm really excited to see a lot of our favourite plants at Chelsea instead of the usual lupin, iris, delphinium, brigade. I'm sure you are too. The idea of that grand pavilion being full of crab apples and seeing the resident blackbirds flitting about in them. And, you know, I mean, I'm excited to see the David Austin stand, because those roses, they should be 12 foot high by now.
And we'll have
they?
Hips and all sorts, won't we? So it's going to be, and colour, that sort of colour that roses go.
And you're
going to
be,
foliage.
I'm sure, in a gorgeous orange autumnal flowing silk gown. I don't know if the Queen's coming to meet you. I don't know.
Who knows?
Have you got your wardrobe sorted for Chelsea? Because that's the big thing, isn't it?
It's so funny that you say that, because last night I couldn't sleep. There always comes a stage in any Chelsea, no matter what you're doing, you know, where you start to worry about it. And last night was my first night that I really couldn't sleep because of, you know, making lists in my head and have I got that covered. And we are a team. So Gemma and Mary and Catherine and Millie in my office, we were all working on it to some capacity. And it's like, has somebody let that plate drop or whatever?
Yes.
So in the middle of the night, I was looking at clothes, Arthur, thinking, I do really need a new frock. I've kind of got my sights set on something. I don't like to do too obviously floral. So
no.
I'd quite like to have something. I'd love a vampire's wife dress, but I can't afford that, in kind of a really deep purple. I'm getting to that age where, you know, there's that poem, isn't there? When I grow old, I shall always wear purple.
I've not heard that one.
Yes. So I kind of want something very purple. And obviously it's got to have some orange on it somewhere. So because purple and orange are my favourite colours. And this autumn, we're going to be able to go a bit wild with that, aren't we?
Mm. So what favourite plants are you hoping to have on the garden at Chelsea?
There's a lot. I mean, I'm going to finally kind of sort those out next week, which seems terrifically late. So, but we are going to have a range of dahlias, still not had those selected quite yet. Mm. So loads of grasses.
Yeah.
So lovely. I'm quite excited. And what I'm worried about at the moment is there's a hydrangea, I wonder if you know it, called Candlelight.
Not heard
of
her.
Yeah, and it's a white that changes to kind of a sort of deep maroony purple.
Wow.
I don't want the white.
No, you want the maroony purple.
I want the dusty kind of maroony purple. So I'm kind of got watching that like a hawk at the moment.
Is this in your own garden?
So no, this is at the show garden.
Right,
so,
okay.
Yeah, so because we need some dusty colours. So we've got some Actaeas and that sort of thing, and grasses, Penicetum Hamel, and there's a lovely Panicum called Squaw that I'm really
love
liking.
Love all the Panicums. Yeah.
Yeah. And they have that lovely flash of kind of maroon on the foliage. And then we're wanting to pick that up with some really bright kind of, I want the garden to feel rich and opulent, yes, and kind of a last hurrah at the end of autumn. Mm. I don't want this wishy-washy trying to be very grown up with silvery kind of blues and pale pinks and very grown up. That makes me feel uncomfortable. I want the garden to be a chocolate box of autumn. In all those russets and golds and reds and maroons. So we're going Nyphophia. It's whether, you know, Fire King is better than Lucifer. So, for example.
Yes, that'll be interesting, won't it?
Yeah. So I'll find that out on Monday. And also, I don't mind a bit of seed head as well coming
fantastic.
In. So.
Well, I want to talk to you about seed heads. I've got this idea of bringing this huge bundle of red millet that we could hang upside down somewhere as a bird feeder.
Let's do that.
Because that'll be the arrangement with the dahlias, you see.
It's just so important to have these late season perennials. And we've got hawthorns that I'm hoping will be, you know, in red with their berries and things all over the garden. But it's really important that we also have a story that shows how important all of these plants are to our wildlife populations.
Yeah.
I do grow Chat Noir because I love it at home.
Yeah, we're all guilty of a dirty double, aren't we?
Yeah, but, a dirty double.
Yeah, but I think increasingly we've got to have the virginal singles. I mean, me and Sarah talk about this all the time on almost every episode. We're constantly telling people what varieties are good for the bees and butterflies and the birds. But I just think it's about balance, isn't it? I do think you need a bit of that clout that these big man-made beasts give a garden pot.
And it is amazing, actually, that sometimes the pollinators do get in. They do have fun on some of those doubles. They manage somehow. They squeeze their way in, a bit like, you know, trying to push into the best nightclub ever. You know, they squeeze
petal bouncers, they smooze in, and then they have a fun
Your name's
time
not
in that
on the
middle.
List. Yeah, exactly. And then they come out staggering out. So many nights like that in my youth. So yeah. I'm quite excited. Do you know a plant called Digiplexus, Falcon Fire?
Vulcan Fire rings a bell, but it's probably a variety of a dahlia rather than Digiplexus.
So that's a plant that I don't know that I've just come across. So, and it's Mark Straver at Hortus that's introduced
me to that. Oh, we love Mark. Mark's a genius
grower. We love Mark.
Grower.
So he really is. So he's introduced me to that. Mm. I'm just wondering how that's going to look. So it's a cross between our native digitalis and the Canary Island digitalis. So it flowers for a lot longer. And it's flower spike. It comes to about a meter. I'm hoping that's the thing. I'll talk about that in a tick. But it comes to about a meter. And it's like a real kind of lipstick. I've got a lipstick called Flat Out Fabulous that Mark and I always talk about. It's about saying, no, we want Flat Out Fabulous pink. So, and then it's splashed with orange around it with just a kind of dusting of cream at the center. So it might be appallingly awful.
Yeah, it's either going to sink or swim, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but I'm interested to see how it looks because he's just getting those grown on and into spikes for me to see if they're kind of in or out of the
in
Chelsea
one of his
experience.
Amazing polytunnels. Because I do feel for all the growers that supply these shows. They've really had it tough, haven't they? Tougher than the garden centers because a lot of them don't have a garden centre. They just grow, don't they, for these shows, for the designers, and they've not been able to do the shows. So I'm really pleased that Chelsea's happening for their sake as well as the garden designers such as yourself.
Arthur, it's been really a testing time for nurseries because Chelsea, the shows have been cancelled on and off through no fault of anybody's, but their whole income stream and has been kind of based on that. And then the plants have gone over, so they've lost that money or they've had to ask, you know, whoever's buying those plants if they could be kind and give them some kind of, you know, sort of fallback on the financials.
On the living stock that they can't just put into storage and go, that can be, you know, they've got to pay somebody to either pot it on or repot it or redress it or prune it. You know, it's all money,
isn't it? Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is. And then, you know, with all the bringing things in from Europe and all of the stuff that DEFRA, all of the plant passporting and things and the checks, and then also not having staff available this past year.
Massive issue because of immigration.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. So it's been challenging in so many ways. And And so, you know, we mustn't just think that, oh, it's just us designers that have had it tough with moving things around. It's the whole of our industry, actually. Mm. So, and times have been difficult for everyone. So the fact that we've got something like Chelsea, where we've got this beautiful end of season hurrah, it's a one-off special to kind of celebrate what we all do and love on a day-to-day basis in a completely different time of year. The light will be different. It will be spectacular to garden with different light at show. So we'll have dusk, which we never properly have at Chelsea. So some of the gardens will be lit. We've got lots of lighting going on in Wonderful. The Gaze Burwell stand. So to celebrate something completely different that inspires people to keep on growing later into the year, keep on supporting wildlife and supporting our industry by buying plants and getting designers in, employing contractors, you know, employing garden designers, florists, hoop blooming rah.
Well, I couldn't think of a better note to end this wonderful conversation on than what you've just said. But I really can't wait to fill Hugo, my taxi driver's car boot up with dahlias from Perchill and bring them to you at Chelsea. It's going to be a wonderful collaboration and I'm really honoured that you want me to do it for you. So look out for Anne-Marie on the main avenue at Chelsea. It's on telly, isn't it, as normal, I think?
Yeah, I think so. I don't really know.
Surely it's going to be on telly. Yeah, it'll be not Kirsty Walk, who's the blonde lady that presents it, who's normally on BBC News 24. She'll be there presenting it, I'm sure.
Sophie Raworth.
I don't think we can tell people that unless it's a nice one.
I don't think I will tell it to you. It's a lovely story, but not for everybody's ears.
But yes, I'm sure a lot of you do follow Anne-Marie, but do follow her on Instagram if you fancy wonderful garden knowledge. You know, it's basically one-on-one learning. It's fantastic at My Real Garden. So thank you for joining me, Anne-Marie, for this lovely chat. See you soon. Oh,
thank you for having me. Can't wait to help you with those armfuls of flowers.
Yes, can't wait. Lots of love.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed our podcast. Next week, we will be talking about plants that are very, very dear to both Arthur and my hearts, which are dahlias, which I know we've chatted about a bit before, but this is a dahlia spectacle special.
You can find more information, photos and advice sheets on all the plants and recipes that we talk about in this podcast by heading to the links in the show notes or on our website at sarahaven.com.